which are topical and relevant and designed for the general public so they can have access to Krishna consciousness. And we identified basically five purposes that we want to accomplish as a temple. And they all start with S. You know, it's nice to have all these things with starting with the first letters, and also you can remember them easier. We want to center our lives around God, which is called sadhana. We want to connect with other devotees, which is called sangha. We want to cultivate spiritual maturity, which is called shiksha. We want to use the talents and abilities that God gave us to glorify Him, and that's called seva. And then we want to also communicate to other people and bring them here to enjoy the same pleasures that we enjoy, and that's called sankirtan. So those are sadhana, sangha, seva, shiksha, and sankirtan. Those are basically what we could call the five purposes of ISKCON. And we are meant, many of you, most of us, have, it's been on a mountaintop or maybe listening to bhajan or something like that. We've experienced moments of ecstasy, euphoria, when we felt like God just came down and touched us, and we wanted more of that. We realized in that moment that this is what life is all about, and we want more of that. But the problem was, we didn't know how to sustain it. We didn't know how to capture it and continue to live life on that level. And a lot of people, they try artificially to get themselves on that higher level of consciousness through substance abuse and drugs and alcohol. That'll never work, because after the high, you're lower than you were before. You know, the price that you pay for those few moments of euphoria is too great, because you end up being more depressed than you were before. And so you just get into a vicious cycle. You need to learn how to access spiritual pleasure without the use of material aids. Because when you use something material for a so-called spiritual benefit, you're defeating yourself, because material things follow the most basic of material laws, which is that what goes up must come down. Yeah, let's do that once more. What goes up must come down. Yeah. So one time the poet Allen Ginsberg, he was a famous poet in America, and he met Prabhupada, and he said, "Don't you think that Krishna had the good humor to come in Kali Yuga as a pill?" And at that time, the pill of choice was LSD. And Prabhupada said, "No, you can never get a spiritual result from taking something material." So how do we experience life as a thrill at every moment? Prabhupada says in his purport to the Bhagavad Gita that we're actually, we're not just meant to experience those moments randomly, occasionally, and intermittently. Some of us, we get such a moment once in a year, or maybe once in a decade. And that's all too infrequent for us. The great saints and sages, like Srila Prabhupada, tell us that we're meant to live life on that level 24 hours a day, every day. That's if you're in spiritual health, then that's how you're supposed to experience life. And if you're not experiencing life as a thrill at every moment, it means that we're not spiritually wholesome and we're not spiritually healthy. So the subject of this talk is how to experience life as a thrill at every moment. And I need to get in such a place that I can click the remote here to the computer if it's going to work. Oh, just took it off the air. Okay, and how we enjoy life are, again, based around these five purposes. We're put here for a purpose, and that purpose is subdivided into five areas. And so by fulfilling our purpose in these areas, we will learn how to experience life on the highest possible level that it can be experienced. And the first purpose of the five purposes I mentioned is centering our life around God, or enjoying a transcendental relationship with Him. Now, in the desert, the animal sees what it thinks is a mirage, where there's cool, clear water flowing. But the animal doesn't calculate, wait a minute, hold on a second, this is in the desert. Maybe I should mistrust what I'm seeing, because water is not generally to be found in the desert. However, the animal doesn't have that discriminative faculty, and the animal runs after the so-called water and dies of exhaustion because the water is not there. It's a mirage. It's receding in the distance. It's a phantasmagoria. So it brings about the demise of the animal who is not in knowledge. So we are kind of in that same position. We all want happiness. We all want the highest quality and level of happiness, but it never occurs to us to think that we're looking for it in the wrong place. We're looking for it in the wrong place. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that that which is real has no cessation, that which is false has no endurance. So those things which pass for happiness in this world, when you apply this criterion for them, they're not really happiness. Oh, I'm looking forward to a good meal. I'm looking forward to a good meal. Thanksgiving. In America, we just had Thanksgiving where people just gorge themselves like that. They look forward to Thanksgiving for months. There's all kinds of hype and newspaper ads, and they can't wait to sit down to the Thanksgiving meal. And an hour later, they're totally miserable. Oh my gosh, I ate too much. Oh my gosh, like that. So where's happiness? They felt anxiety from being hungry, and then they overcompensated for that anxiety by overeating, and then they felt another type of anxiety by being too sated, too overindulged. And in the meantime, there was a period there of a few minutes when they were getting some temporary happiness of some things sliding over the tongue and interacting with the taste buds. So according to the Bhagavad Gita, that's not happiness. That's just temporary relief from suffering. Real happiness, if anything that's real, anything that's real is going to be eternal. Now, your body is not real. I mean, it exists. I mean, it certainly exists. I'm not saying it's I can put my hand through you or anything like that, or that you can walk through walls. But by the definition of the Bhagavad Gita, your body is not real. It's because it's temporary. It's not eternal. But you are real. You are real. Your body is not real, but you are real. So if you are real and your body is not real, what can we conclude? I am, fill in the blank word, blank this body. I am blank this body. I am not this body. I am not this body. And the problem is not that this body doesn't exist. The body exists. We're not saying it's not there. And you exist. But the problem is your body is not real because it's temporary. And you are real because you're eternal. So you're not the body, you see. And when you identify with something that's not real, you're never going to be happy. Because the real you needs to experience real happiness, which is eternal. And that's what we need to look in the right place for. And this material world is not it. And it's full of pleasure seekers. This is a nightclub scene, as best I could tell, with a rock band playing on the band. And it's a smoke-filled atmosphere. And there's all that, you know, electricity of men and women and so on and so forth. But it's not the right methodology for enjoying because it's only going to give you occasional happiness and it's only going to give you conditional happiness. It's not going to give you lasting happiness. And these are the five criterions. When you know that you're experiencing real happiness, you'll be able to identify it because of the presence of these five criterions. Real happiness is unconditional. It's unlimited, it's unshakable, it's unearned, and it's unending. We may not get through all these tonight, but we'll at least go for a half an hour or so. You know, I don't know what it's like in India, but in America, everybody watches the weather forecast on Thursday night to see what it's going to be like on the weekend. And what does the weatherman talk about? What is the word he uses to tell you whether you're going to enjoy this weekend or whether your enjoyment is going to be hampered? He talks about the weather, what? The weather conditions. He talks about the weather conditions. So basically he's saying, oh, conditions are going to be good this weekend, you can get out and hike and swim and enjoy, you see? Or he may say, it's going to be a bad weekend. Actually, if there's clouds and it rains, from so many different points of view, that's a good thing. Krishna says, everyone subsists on food grains. Food grains come from rain. Rain comes from sacrifice. It's said that when rain falls on the head of a serpent, it creates jewels. When rain falls in the ocean, it produces pearls. So actually, rain is a very, very good thing. All kinds of prosperity comes from rain. But in terms of what I want to do this weekend, I'm hoping for sunny and mild and clear conditions. So right there, that tells me that I'm looking for conditional happiness. And so if the weatherman gives me the green light, oh boy, we're going to have fun this weekend. And if the weatherman gives me the yellow light of caution, we're depressed. On the one hand, we're looking forward to good conditions for enjoyment on the weekend. And in the latter case, we're not looking forward to the weekend. Now, in England, they've hit upon a unique solution to the drug addict problem. Their approach to the drug addict problem is to give them some drugs. The government of England actually gives a ration of drugs to addicts because they figure it's better to give them something rather than to have them going out and trying to rob and commit violence on people to get the money to buy it. So they get registered and they get a certain, they actually go to a government window and they actually get a little package of whatever it is that they're craving. Now, we should not mistake that and conclude that the Queen of England, number one, approves of it, or number two, is a drug pusher. First of all, the government does not approve of it, but they're just making the best use of a bad bargain. It is not approved, but they allow it to happen under certain circumstances. So the enjoying spirit that we're so much addicted to in this day and age, we all feel it's me and it's mine and it's all about me and God put me here to enjoy, and when I enjoy, God enjoys. That is illicit. That is illicit. That is not condoned by God. He recommends a simple life of sense control in order to... Now, he doesn't just want to spoil your happiness. He doesn't want to just rain on your parade. He wants you to experience eternal happiness, which is unconditional, unlimited, unshakable, and unending. He wants the best thing for you. And so he advises you not to sell out for some cheap happiness. Not to sell out for that. And so, but at the same time, if we're insistent, if we're really hooked, then sense gratification is allowed to go on. It's allowed to go on. We have motor cars, we have non-veg restaurants, we have more and more liquor stores, we have people walking dogs. That's an amazing thing for me to see. In America, of course, everyone has a big dog and they walk him. And but when I first came to India in 1969, the dogs were those sort of hairless, scruffy things on the street, you know, with yellow teeth and all. Nowadays, the dogs are more healthy than the people, you know. Like that. I saw a Dalmatian the other day. Some guy's got one of those spotted Dalmatian dogs. He's walking in the streets. But so God is allowing sense gratification to go on under certain conditions, but it doesn't mean, number one, that he approves of it, and number two, it could be and will be finished at any time. Let me repeat that. It could be and it will be finished at any time. Just like the government of England, someone stands up in Parliament and says, you know, I'm fed up. We're taking hard-earned taxpayers' money and we're giving it to drug addicts. They don't deserve it. And then some other people in Parliament say, yeah, that's right. You know, we got other priorities and certainly we shouldn't. We could spend that money on health care and so many things. And they take a vote and what do you know? Next day, they go to the window and they say, we just shut down the program. So the program the program of consumerism, of capitalism, is going to be shut down sooner or later because God does not really approve of it, but he's letting it go on, hoping that by your own introspection or by scriptural readings or by interacting with the sadhus who are experiencing happiness by sleeping on, not by, but they're sleeping on the floor. Devotee just showed me where they're sleeping here next door in the evening. They're eating very simple food. They keep their clothes in a locker. And yet look at the big smiles on all the residents here. Look at the big smiles on all the residents here. So the hope of God is that everyone will get some sadhu sangha. And if people are not astute enough to search out sadhu sangha on their own, the sadhus are so compassionate that they're going out into the marketplace every day with books and sankirtan and giving the people the opportunity to associate with them so that they'll get a little taste of what real happiness is. And then hopefully we'll voluntarily give up our life of consumerism and addictive sense gratification in favor of spiritual life, which yields eternal pleasures. If we don't voluntarily wean ourselves, then it will be forcefully done sooner or later. Prabhupada said the motor car is a fad. 100 years ago we didn't have it, and in the future we won't have it again. Obviously, it's not going to be around forever. It's only going to last for a limited period of time. Either it's just going to make the atmosphere so polluted that everybody's got cancer, or you'll run out of oil, and then you'll run out of all the alternative fuel. Their big brainstorm is to use the grains that we eat. They're running out of fossil fuels, so let's take soybeans and wheat and grains and use biofuels. And then, of course, the price of bread triples overnight. You see what I'm saying? So I'm not an economic predictor or an economic analyst. I haven't been on CNN lately. But I don't have to be an expert. I don't have to be a PhD to know that our present life of consumerism will come to an end. Even Gandhiji, 50 years ago, he said God has made enough for everyone's need, but not enough for their greed. So in the interest of allowing us a kind of happiness which is not dependent on any conditions, Krishna has spoken the following words we have here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There are many living entities within the ocean who enjoy the activities of eating, sleeping, defending, and mating. If such insignificant entities can enjoy life within the water, why can't the Supreme Lord, who is all-powerful, sleep on the cool body of a serpent and enjoy in the turmoil of violent ocean waves? Now, if the weatherman on Thursday night says there's a 30% of showers, we get all depressed because the conditions aren't going to be right for our outdoor activities on the weekend. Okay, we're daunted by the prediction of maybe some showers. Now, the Lord's happiness is unconditional because at the time of cosmic devastation, when it rains and rains and rains and the waves are like high as mountains, and everything is being destroyed. This isn't just a weekend shower. These are the waters of devastation. This is the Shrayamvataka clouds, right? So what is the Lord's response to this? How concerned is the Lord? He goes to sleep. He decides to take a little nap. Now, is that unconditional happiness? And as he's sleeping, the waters of devastation are kind of rocking him here and there, and he's enjoying it. He's enjoying the devastation of the universe. For us, it's like, oh my gosh, there goes McDonald's, oh my gosh, it's floating away. What am I going to do, It's not that big a deal to the Lord. In fact, this whole universe is compared to a single seed in a big bag of mustard seeds. So from his perspective, there's no condition that would defray his happiness. And here's a description of materialistic conditional happiness from Srila Prabhupada. Generally, a materialistic person becomes very happy when there is something for his sense gratification in his body. But when he sees that others have something for their sense gratification and he hasn't, he is sorry and envious. When he is expecting some retaliation from an enemy, he is in a state of fear. And when he cannot successfully execute something, he becomes dejected. On the other hand, a devotee who is always transcendental to all these disturbances is very dear to Krishna. I heard on the internet a little bit of a talk by Chaitanya Charan from Pune. I haven't met him, but I'm going to stop in at Pune tomorrow, and I hope I meet him because he's kind of like a hero of mine. The books he's written are just fantastic and talk. And I just happened to hear a little MP3, and he was describing the scenario of a man who's just got... He spent, I don't know how much it would be in India, but in America, a fancy, hot off the line, new model car would cost you about $50,000 to $70,000. A real eye-catching car. So he's got this car, he's put a down payment on it, and he's driving. He's driving down the street, and sure enough, heads are turning as he goes down the street. Everyone stops what they're doing, and they're looking, and they're nudging other people, and they're saying, look at that, check it out. This guy has got the MX-33, you know, he is hot. And the fellow is not really enjoying the car. That's not the source of his enjoyment. The car is just getting him from point A to B. Probably a Toyota Corolla would get more miles and more economically and do a better job. What he's really enjoying is the attention and the prestige that he's getting. And he's spending, you know, $50,000, $60,000 for getting that prestige. And it's just momentary. It's momentary. It lasts for a few days until some other car manufacturer comes out with some other hot car, and then someone gets it, and then no one's even paying attention to him anymore. They're saying, oh, look at that one. That one's more recent. That one's more expensive. So his happiness was not based on the car. It was based on the false prestige. And we build our lives around this illusory sense of happiness. We create friends, enemies, and neutral parties based on our calculation. This person is my friend because he'll promote my sense gratification. He's proving that he's not going to help me in my quest for sense. So he's an enemy. I better keep an eye on him. And you, I'm not sure about yet. I haven't made up my mind. You know what I'm saying? So where is happiness? This is hell. This is hell. And this is the kind of hell that we routinely live in. With conditional happiness. And Vyasadeva, according to Narad Muni, Vyasadeva compiled the Vedas. And as we all know, initially, the Vedas covered four areas: dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Sense gratification, mundane religiosity, economic development, and liberation. And after Vyasadeva had compiled the Vedas, covering all these different areas of conditional happiness, temporary happiness, he felt unfulfilled. He felt despondent. He had not felt that the purpose for which God put him here, he's called Mahamune Kriti. He's a literary incarnation of God. He felt that his purpose had not been fulfilled. At that point, he consulted with Narada Muni, and Narada Muni said, you have neglected in all of your vast output of literary energy and of all your erudition and all the topics that you've covered, everything is temporary. And the happinesses that you offer through the Vedas are all conditional. For instance, elevation of the heavenly planet. You go to the heavenly planets because of the piety, the punya that you've accumulated here on earth. However, you can only stay in Svarloka as long as the result of your piety lasts. And as it runs out and when it's exhausted, you have to marcha loka vishanti. You come back down again to this world of birth and death. For instance, you might work hard, earn money, put some money aside, and then you get to go to Hawaii, which is like heaven. But how long can you stay in Hawaii? You can only stay in Hawaii as long as your savings last. And when your savings are exhausted, you have to come back and go to work in Bombay. So the having is a conditional and temporary. And that's the best that the Vedas can offer. And so Krishna cautions, do not be distracted by the flowery words of the Vedas. They seem to offer you something very desirable and very alluring, but it's flowery. And what is a flower if not temporary? What is a flower? Why does Krishna use that word flower? Because flowers just last a few hours or a few days. And Krishna says, we're meant for eternal happiness. We're meant for unconditional happiness. And so in order to allow living beings to access happiness, according, then Narada Muni said, you need to compile the Amala Puranam, the spotless Purana. You need to glorify that Supreme Lord who, when the universe is being devastated, he lies down on the waters of devastation and goes to sleep. See, that's the guy you need to get hooked up with if you want to experience unconditional happiness. So here's what I just described. This is just what I just described. I don't even need to read it. It's called Karma Kanda. Called Karma Kanda. You do good works, you go to heaven. You do bad works, you go to hell. But in both cases, they give you a temporary result. They give you temporary pleasure or temporary pain, but nothing permanent. And so we want to transcend what's called Karma Kanda. And the alternative to Karma Kanda, those two Ks, is another two Ks called Krishna Katha. Karma Kanda gives you temporary illusory happiness, that KK. This KK, Krishna Katha, gives you unlimited transcendental happiness. As it's said here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which Vyasadeva wrote at the advice of Narada Muni, says here, the highest perfection of life is to enjoy life constantly in the association of the Lord. And one who can relish this does not aspire after any temporary enjoyment of the material world via other media. Notice the use of the word enjoy here. Krishna is saying to enjoy life. Now, unfortunately, most people, for them, religion is just a bunch of thou shalt nots. That's what religion is. It's a bunch of pious, stuck-up people who look down their nose at you, who can't have any fun because they're too worried about all the things that they can't do. You know, that's what religion means to a lot of people, unfortunately. But and that is what religion can boil down to, because religion means rules. Religion means rules. That's what religion is, rules. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vyasadeva is no longer talking about religion. He's talking about relation. He's talking about relation. Religion will not give you happiness. Religion, if you're aware of the laws of nature and you avoid them, it will help you avoid a lot of suffering. But religion will not give you happiness. You'll only get the kind of unlimited happiness after which we hanker through a relationship with God. That's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, sarva dharman parityagya mam ekam saranam vraja aham tam sarva papi moksha isi mamsi. Krishna says, give up religion. Give up religion in favor of a relation. And you know, there's all these heavy people that say, you can't do that, and you can't do this, and you can't do that, and they're laying a guilt trip on you. And that's why a lot of people don't go to church or the temple, because it's all about laying guilt trips on people like that. You can't do this, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. So Krishna says, in case you're worried that because you're loving me instead of being a rules and regulation man, in case you're worried that someone's going to lay a guilt trip on you and make you feel guilty, don't. Don't. Aham tam sarva papibhyo. If you think that by loving me and you might be neglecting one or two religious principles and someone might criticize you for it because you're going to get a bad reaction, don't worry. I'm in your corner. I'm backing you. You're not going to get any bad reaction at all. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there was one devotee. His name was, forget his name actually, but he was guarding cows. He was guarding cows at night, protecting them from the forest animals, and he had a sword to keep tigers and so on and so forth away. Well, it was an Amavasya, and there was no moon, and a tiger came and attacked one of his cows, and he swung the sword, thinking that he was aiming at the tiger, but it was dark, and instead he killed the cow. So Sukracharya heard about it, and he cursed him. You killed a cow? Oh, you're going to go to hell for 1,000 years. But you know what? Curse didn't work. Because he was a devotee. He was engaged in an intimate relationship of love with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he spent the time, when he was guarding the cows, chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And because he spent his time not just following rules and regulations, but deepening his relationship with the Lord, when he did something that normally would have carried a sinful reaction, it didn't work. And not only did he kill a cow, and that's a great sin according to Vedic culture, but on top of that, he got cursed by Shukracharya, who is the guru of the Daityas, Sarva Shastra. Himakundam, we talked about this morning, he's one of the grahas. Himakundamidarambam, Daityaram Paramam Garam, Sarva Shastra Pravokshanam, Bhargavam Pranamamiham. So he got double whammy there, but neither one of them had any effect because he had Sarva Dharman Parikyakya, he had given up religion in favor of relation. And Krishna assures you, Aham Tam Sarva Papebhyo Mokshasmi Masi Jaha. Don't worry, I will protect you. If you're working in a factory and the foreman is who's normally your boss, he tells you to do this and do this and do this, you normally have to do that. But if one day the president of the company comes down to where you're working and says, I want you to come with me, I've got a special job for you, the foreman may criticize you. You can't do that. You're under me. You have to do what I say. But if you ignore on that particular day the foreman and you go with the owner of the company, you don't have to worry about anything the foreman can do to you. You don't have to worry about it because you're doing a special job for the president of the company. So Krishna says, don't worry about crossing your T's and dotting your I's. Don't worry about following every single rule and regulation. Just love me. Just love me. Patram pushram phalam toyam yome bhakti prayachati. How easy can it be? Can it get any easier than that? Here's the Supreme Lord. He's the source of all the demigods. He experiences unconditional happiness. He offers it. He wants it for you. No father wants to see their children suffering. No. It's intolerable for a father to see their children suffering. They want to stop it as soon as possible, and they want their children to enjoy as quickly as possible. So Krishna, he wants not to put you to a lot of trouble. He wants not to perpetuate your misery. He wants to make that happiness as accessible and as easy and as quickly available as possible. So all he asks for is, in order to reawaken our relationship with him, offer him a flower, fruit, leaf, or water. That's all it asks for. And then in your spare time, chant his holy names. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And he says, in this way, you will gradually more and more and more feel unlimited happiness. Now, I've been pursuing this Krishna consciousness for 40 years. And I can honestly stand before you and say that ecstasy is a companion of the devotee. I'm not saying I experience the kind of pleasure that Prabhupada experienced 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that that what was once a very rare occasion before I was a devotee, the kind of pleasure that would come along once every 10 years, it's almost like God is like teasing you. See, you know, this is what you could get, but instead you're doing this, you know, your nonsense, like that. But I can honestly say that those moments are more and more often and of greater duration. They're no longer uncommon. Devotees are familiar with ecstasy. It's not a rare, it's not an uncommon occurrence. It may not be moment by moment. It may not be even day by day always. But it is frequent and it is common and it is expected and it is esteemed, and we're always making more and more progress. Year after year, you follow a devotee in his career and he's just more and more and more constantly, unconditionally happy. That's just the evolution of that type of happiness like that. So Krishna maintained his fort in Dwarka. Now, second point, unlimited. First point is the happiness is not dependent upon any external conditions. It's eternal and it's transcendental. And the second point is the happiness, which is our right, our inheritance to claim, is also unlimited. Prabhupada, when he would visit Los Angeles, the Pacific Ocean is just about 3 miles away from the temple there in Culver City. And every August, they have a big Rath Yatra right on the beach. And on a Sunday afternoon, they usually have it the first Sunday in August, there's like 250,000 people on the beach there. And there's the Rath Yatra and a big mele in the park and all like that. So Prabhupada said that as vast as the Pacific Ocean is, it still has its boundaries. We all go about our business doing the Rath Yatra, and here's this huge power, this Pacific Ocean right here. But it doesn't particularly bother us because we know it has its boundaries, it has its limits. But spiritual pleasure has no boundaries. It has no limits. We're meant to experience life as a thrill at every moment, and then the next moment it gets better, the next moment it gets better, the next moment it gets, and that goes on eternally with no diminution and no cessation whatsoever. Even when they had the tsunami a couple of years ago around Christmas time, as out of control as the oceans got, still, if you were, I don't know, like maybe quarter of a mile or 3/8 of a mile, if you were that far from the beach and you saw that tsunami coming, if you're a really good runner, you could outrun it and maybe get your backside and your pants wet because the tsunami itself only had enough force to come in about at most a half a mile. And then it just couldn't sustain itself, and then it lost its momentum, and then it would recede. So if you could get yourself more than like half a mile away from the beach, you would survive that, because even that had its limits. But spiritual happiness, it's like a tsunami of happiness which doesn't stop. It has no point where it's checked, but it keeps coming and coming and coming and coming. And we're not running away from it. We're running to it. We want that. You know, there are so many references. The great saints and sages are saying, please submerge. Submerge yourself in the ocean of the nectar devotion. You know, go under. Go under. That's what life is all about. And Krishna had unlimited happiness, and he also dispensed unlimited happiness to no less than 16,000 queens in Dwarka Fort. Now, most conditioned souls cannot even satisfy one queen. Yeah, you never do anything for me, you know, blah, 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 like that. Krishna is unlimited to the point that he built a palace for each queen, an opulent palace. There were jewels embedded in the walls, so they didn't need lights, because the jewels would dispense enough light. You could see, you could read by it. The sheets were made of silk. And more importantly, Krishna expanded himself so that he was with each and every queen. He was with each and every queen. And each and every queen was fully satisfied that Krishna was with me and fully attentive to me only. Little did they know that, you know, down the block in the neighboring palace, the other queen felt the same way, and so on, and 16,000 queens. And some people criticize, you know, how could God have 16,000 wives? And Prabhupada said, why 16,000? Why not 16 million? Why not 16 billion? Because God is unlimited. unlimited. Every living being is the prakriti. God is the purusha. And we're all the feminine counterparts of the Lord. So in one sense, we're all, he's in every one of our hearts. And if we pray enough to him and we develop our relationship with him, then he will stand before us face to face. And that's what he wants. Otherwise, why is he taking the trouble to come and speak Bhagavad Gita and to inspire Vyasadeva to recite the Srimad Bhagavatam? So why only 16,000? Why not 16 million? Why not 16 billion? Why shouldn't every single living being on the planet have an intimate relationship, a face-to-face relationship with God? That's the message of Dwarka. Husband of all, when he so descends, he proves how much greater is his ability to enjoy, and he exhibits his power of enjoyment by marrying 16,000 wives at once. The Lord doesn't need 16,000 wives, but he does it to show you that you'll not be bereft. You'll not be bereft, you know. Some might, due to poor fund of information, they might think, well, there's only one God, and so if I go to the spiritual world, I might have to wait in line, a long line, like a Tirupati, you know, you wait 8 hours and then you get 2 seconds and then they push you like that. So, you know, maybe they got the impression from Tirupati, I don't know, you know, that you wait a long line and then you get to shake God's hand and that's it. You don't get to see him for another 2 million years. You go back and get in line again, you know. Well, no wonder if you think that, why you're not passionate about going to the spiritual world. The fact is God is unlimited and he expands himself so that each and every devotee in the spiritual world feels that God is with him or her or with their group of people and especially attentive to you. You know, I gave the example this morning during the class and some devotees chuckled about it. We were talking not about devotionally inclined, chaste, faithful women, but we were talking about the other kind. The other kind. And the other kind, their nature is they're not faithful. They're not faithful. Such a type of woman, and it could go for a man too. I mean, it could apply for both genders. But in this case, the example is given by Chanaka Pandit that a faithless woman, a woman without moral standards and without Krishna consciousness, can be so faithless that she's embracing one man, looking over his shoulder at another man, and thinking of a third. Krishna says, "Aham tam sarva papi." Don't worry. If you surrender to me, I surrender to you. And believe me, we get the best part of that bargain. Krishna is if he is faithful, he is faithful. And if he makes a promise, you can count on that promise. After all, it's his determination that causes the sun to rise every day, exactly on time, that causes the sun to set. He sent the 5 Pandavas into that maelstrom of the Kurukshetra war with so many dangerous Maharatis like Ashwatthama and Dronacharya. And before the war started, he predicted, he said, "I'll send you in, but you trust me, I'll also bring you out. I'll also bring you out." When he shows his universal form to Arjuna, and Arjuna sees all the soldiers being rushing into the form, and he says, "Except for you, the Pandavas, all soldiers on both sides will be slain." So he promised that before the war even started, and lo and behold, after the war ended, you check it out, he was completely faithful. He did exactly what he said he would do. So if you surrender, if you spend your time, instead of watching the TV, reading the Bhagavad Gita, instead of talking gossip, chanting Hare, one devotee, he's very modest. He's very modest. So he doesn't advertise the fact. But he was telling me that he was chanting for so many, he was chanting 16 rounds with all the other devotees. And then he was saying, "Okay, that's finished. Okay, let me talk something. Let me go and talk with some devotee, and talk here and talk there and like that." And then he thought, wait a minute. Why do I have to stop at 16? And why do I have to just go around, blah, 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 blah. Right? I'm sure it was all transcendental subject matter having to do with ISKCON and all. But still he thought, why don't I just take that time and instead of just thinking that, okay, 16 baas, Prabhupada says minimum 16. And anyway, 16 is like, if you just think 16, that's like religion. But if you think, let me always be chanting Hare Krishna, and then just minimum, then that's like relation. So this devotee, he wanted to actually elevate his perception of his rounds beyond religion to relation. And so he stopped thinking that my rounds are done now, and he stopped going around and chatting with devotees. And now he chants 32 rounds a day. And he only does it by just saving time that he was wasting before. Prabhupada once asked a devotee, are you chanting 16 rounds? And the devotee said, I don't have time. Prabhupada said, do you have time to sleep? Yeah. Do you have time to eat? Yeah. Well, then you got time to chant your rounds. Like that. It's just a matter of managing our time. And the benefit is certainly worth it. Magchita madprana, madgata prana, bodhyanta parashpa, katayantas chamam nityam, tushyanti cha, ramanti cha. Tushyanti cha, ramanti cha. This is not happiness that you wear on your sleeve. This is not the cheap nightclub, modern, sense gratificatory, stimulatory happiness. This is deep ramanti cha, tushyanti cha, ramanti cha. It is deep, deep happiness, unshakable, unlimited happiness like the ocean. You know how deep a creek is, you know how deep a stream is, you know how deep a river is, but you can't even measure how deep the ocean is. It's unlimitedly deep. One time a devotee looked at Prabhupada's passport photo, the photo that he got taken in India before he came to America. And Prabhupada's, the corners of his mouth were down like that. And he was like this, you know. And the devotee said, Prabhupada, you don't look very happy in that picture. And Prabhupada said, oh, really? He said, that was one of my greatest moments of transcendental ecstasy. That's tushyanti cha, ramanti cha. And here's the Lord can generate unlimited pleasure. His name, attributes, pastimes, entourage are unlimited. And those who relish them can do so unlimitedly and never feel satiated. Ramanti yoganamanante iti rama padadeshu param brahma bidiyate. In the Pad Purana, it says the happiness that one derives from Brahmananda, from merging, from becoming one with the Lord, that happiness is an atomic drop in the ocean of the nectar of devotion, of happiness that you feel when you actually develop your relationship with the Lord. So, we're not going to finish. There's three more, and I've only covered two. Shall I do one more? Okay, so we'll take a few more minutes and do one. Talked about unconditional happiness. These are the characteristics of real happiness. It's unconditional, it's unlimited, and it's unshakable. It's unshakable. It cannot be budged. And Krishna is, like I said, he makes a promise, he is unshakable. Rukmini was disinclined to enter into, to participate in an arranged marriage with Sisupal. Her brother Rukmi didn't like Krishna, and to spite Krishna, he intentionally betrothed her to Sisupal just to spite Krishna. And she sent a letter to Krishna, please take me, please kidnap me. And she sent it by a Brahmin. And then her marriage day came, and she was all dressed up. And she was actually walking, to the mandap where the vows would be taken. And she was a little worried that why hasn't Krishna showed up? Is Krishna going to show up? What's going to happen? And she was kind of like drawing it out. And she was like taking really small steps, and going as slow as she could. And she was just looking everywhere. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? And then Krishna, he's unshakable. He just wanted to have a little fun with the situation. But there was no question. Rukmini is the goddess of fortune. She's put herself. Krishna, I'm at your mercy. I'm at your mercy. Just like Draupadi, when she couldn't keep the sari on anymore, and she said, Govinda, Krishna, I am at your mercy. Krishna was unshakable. He was unshakable. He's never going to let his devotee down. He's always going to appear. It may be, you know, at the last second, just to kind of have some fun with it, but he is going to appear. That's all. And here's Ravana also pestering Sita. He said, Ravana said, you know, your husband is like, he's got nothing, he's nobody. He's just a hermit in the forest. You know, look at me, man. I got this one, I got this scar. He showed his chest, you know. He said, this, usually it would work, you know, with the girls, you know. he showed his chest. This was when I defeated Indra. This is when I defeated Kuvera. This is when I dueled Yamaraj and all. Sita, you know, Sita's like, she's not interested. You know, it worked with other queens and all, but it didn't work with Sita because Sita was unshakable in her devotion to Ram. If you have a relation with a lion, you're not going to give it up to elope with a jackal. That's just you're not going to do that. You don't even entertain that thought for a moment. So here's Ravana, you know, posturing and I'm looking good, I'm feeling good, I got the goods, you know, I got the perfume behind my ear. I'm irresistible. Well, he was very resistible. She wasn't even interested. And she practically spit at him. And she said, Ram is going to come and kill you just like a lion comes and kills the jackals, you know, who are trying to steal the booty. So that was the characteristic of Sita's attachment to Krishna. To Rama. It was absolutely unshakable. And she lived even 1 year in the palace of Ravana. And you better believe it, Ravana took every opportunity to parade his wealth and his opulences before her, to entice her with, and he would tell all the people around her to glorify him. So for 1 year, she wasn't hearing any glorification of Ram. In fact, they were saying bad things about Ram, but they were saying all the glories of Ravana and all like that. And it went on for 1 year. And you've heard of Stockholm Syndrome, right? Someone takes someone prisoner for a few hours and they start getting attached. Sita was with Ravana for 1 year. She was subject to all kinds of psychological brainwashing. And she did not budge one inch. She was unshakable. And that's what happens when you become an atom at Krishna Rama's lotus feet. You're not going to change that for anything in the world. So here's what she says. She kind of spits out the words to Ravana. She says, she's enraged. Ravana doesn't get the reaction of interest that he was hoping for. He got the reaction that Sita was enraged. And she says, I have taken a vow to follow Ram, who is unshakable as a great mountain, as powerful as Indra and as wise as Brihaspati. I cannot be swerved from Ram's service. He is virtuous and always true to his word. I am dedicated to Rama, who will never abandon his devoted servant. I belong to that Rama, who is like a mighty lion and destroys his enemies with ease and speed. How have you, O Ravana, a jackal, been so brazen as to covet me? And when Satyabhama, just one more instance, she wanted the Parijata tree. Rukmini got a flower, and Satyabhama, you know, that wasn't good enough for her. She's got to have a tree. Rukmini's getting a flower, you got to get me a tree, you know. Krishna's such a henpecked husband, you know. So he says, well, you know, we're going to have to go to the Parijata doesn't exist on earth. It only exists in heaven, and it's Indra's favorite tree, and you know he's not going to give it up without a fight. And Satyabhama says, yeah, I know, but you know, you can do it. And so then Krishna, they just get on Garuda and they just go and they have a big fight. He fights all the demigods, and to satisfy his devotee, he takes the tree by force from Indra, the king of heaven. The greatest heroes of the Yadu dynasty, being protected by the arms of Lord Krishna, always remain fearless in every respect. Their feet trample over the Sudharma assembly house, which the best demigods deserve, but which was taken away from them. If Krishna wants to, he can just take stuff away from those who are undeserving and give it to those who are deserving. He's very bold like that. He's very determined. He's very unshakable. When Duryodhan and Bhima were dueling at the end of Kurukshetra War with the Gadas, it came to a stalemate. Bhima had the strength of 10,000 elephants, but Duryodhan wasn't as strong, but he was very expert. He'd been trained by Balaram. So they fought together for some days, and neither was gaining an advantage over the other. So finally, Bhima looks over at Krishna like, what am I going to do? You know, this is just, I've tried everything, and I'm just not getting the advantage here. And then you all know what Krishna did, right? He slapped. It's another story, but Krishna is God. He knows everything. So he knew the history of Duryodhan, and he knew that all of Duryodhan's body was like iron, and you couldn't kill him. Even if with his strength of 10,000 elephants, Bhima would use all of his strength, and even if Duryodhan wasn't wearing a helmet, and he come and he does like a Barry Bond, you know, right on his head, it wouldn't kill Duryodhan, because it was like iron. But his thigh was vulnerable, and Krishna knew that. So Bhima then, he faked high, and then he went and he hit him low, and he crushed the thigh of Duryodhan, and then he was there, food for the jackals and the crows. So all the religious people, all the rules and regulations, all the mundane moralists who weren't experiencing any happiness at all, not unconditional, not unlimited and not shakable happiness, they were all criticizing Krishna and Bhima. Oh, you, Krishna, you know, you gave him an unfair advantage. Bhima, you're not supposed to hit below the waist, and so on and so forth. But Krishna didn't care a fig for all their criticisms. He was so bold and so unshakable that he took it from by force, because Duryodhan didn't deserve it. If God gives you some talents and abilities and you don't use them, if God blesses you and you don't use that to be a blessing to other people, then God will take that away from you. And that's his promise. If you think, like we started out, sense gratification is not approved by the Lord, it's disapproved, and you're only allowed to do it under his, he just lets it go on, although he doesn't like it at all. But he has the right, he has the ability to finish it up at any time. So if you persist in taking your talents, your abilities, your energy, your finance, and just using them selfishly, then eventually Krishna will come along and you'll be not in the category of Paritranaya Sadhana. The protection is for those who use God's abilities in God's service and for their fellow man. That's who the Paritranaya Sadhana. For those who squander it or misuse it or use it selfishly, you are in the category of Vinasha Chaduskritam. So when Krishna came and forcibly, boldly, and unshakably, without caring about mundane morality and the criticism of so-called religion, he took everything away from Duryodhan. That was the highest morality. Krishna promises that. You mess with what I give you, and I will take it away. If you don't use it, you'll... Let's do that again. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. Once more. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. Right. Those who are directly servitors of the Lord are protected by the Lord from all fearfulness, and they also enjoy the best of things, even if they are forcibly accumulated. So God, if you have a friend, and you're wealthy, and your friend is less so, I was, when I left Utah, there's a family that own a motel, the Patels, and they have this motel called Colony Inn. And motels aren't doing that good nowadays, and he mortgaged a lot of properties and all. So they're really going by on a shoestring. They're really struggling to make the monthly payments are like, you know, $20,000 or something, and they're just paying $15 and not, you know, anyway. But they're a very wonderful family, and they're open-hearted. They'll do anything for the temple. It took me 1 year. 1 year I was asking the devotees in the kitchen, please make dhapatis every day. And it didn't happen. They'd do it for a while, and then they'd stop doing it, and they'd do it for a while, and they'd stop doing it, and they'd do it and stop, while and stop doing it. So I asked Nirmala, I asked Dhruva, she said, what can I do for you? I said, boy, I'd really like some dhapatis every day. 6 months now, every day, she drops her girl at school, and she drives. 6 months every day, she brings 100 dhapatis every day. What the devotees wouldn't do after me asking them for, and she does it. And she's running a motel, and they're in debt, and they've got all kinds of troubles, and she still takes the time for serving Krishna and Krishna's devotees. 100 dhapatis, handmade every day, like that. Yes. And so, as I was coming for Utah, I just went in, because they also have health problems. She's got diabetes, he's got a bad heart. So I just went to check on them. I'm going to be in Utah. So their daughter has one of these, she has one of these $140 Barbie dolls. And Nirma said, you know, this, she was playing, and she says, this doll costs $140. And she said, her friend, Trivedi, bought it for her for Christmas. And they said, no, it's too expensive, we don't want it, and like that. And Trivedi said, this is another little girl her age, but her father's a doctor. She said, look, you're my friend. It gives me great pleasure. It gives me great pleasure to give you this doll as a gesture of friendship. It would give, I will enjoy your having the doll more than my having the doll. God is no different. He enjoys that his devotees have the best of things. That's an expression of his love for them and from his unshakable friendship. Even if he has to take it from someone else and give it. Someone who's not using it properly. Okay, you're not. I'll take it from there and I'll give it here. No, he's unshakable in his determination to support his friendship, his devotees. Arjuna, you all know, Arjuna is a little impetuous. He's a little rash. And he's a little bit arrogant, if the truth be known. But he is totally into a relationship with Krishna. He's so much into a relationship with Krishna that it's described. Sometimes he and Krishna sit on the same bed together and they have a conversation and they're warriors. So what do warriors talk about? They talk about battles, you know, and things they did and feats they accomplished. And so in the intimacy of friendship, sometimes after hearing Krishna talk about a battle that he won or a duel that he fought, Arjuna would say, oh, my friend, you're very truthful. Implying that Krishna might have exaggerated a little bit, you know. And even insulting Krishna a little bit. But if you have an intimate friend, if you have an don't you sometimes have fun insulting each other? Don't you insult each other? And isn't there a special flavor to that? See what I'm saying? So we don't count Arjuna's rashness and arrogance and impetuosity as a character flaw. We don't. Some pop New Age psychologists might say that Arjuna's got to work on his. He's got to work on this. You know, he's got to take a seminar. You know, get a New Age guru or something like that. But we don't care a fig for that because we don't have that standard of perfection. We only have one simple standard of perfection. Are you unearthing? Are you deepening your relationship with Krishna? If you're angry, what about Bhima? Bhima had an anger problem, but he always used his anger for Krishna and Krishna's devotees. So that anger was actually an expression of love, like that. When Jayadrath caused the death of Abhimanyu, Arjuna, without consulting with Krishna, and in front of all the demigods and everybody, he said, unless I kill Jayadratha tomorrow, I'm going to commit suicide. And within 10 seconds, the spies of Duryodhan heard that, and Duryodhan thought, wow, here's a golden opportunity that's just been handed to us by Arjuna. If we all we have to do is keep Jayadratha alive past sunset tomorrow, and Arjuna will kill himself, and then we can win the war. Because without Arjuna, it's a walk in the park. And so they organized the army in the form of a needle. They had the thick part there facing, and then it tapered and tapered and tapered and tapered, and guess who was at the back? Jayadratha. And guess how long that needle was? 49 miles long. So Krishna, Arjuna, literally had to kill, defeat, or outmaneuver every single soldier in the Kaurava army, and they had to do it before sunset. And they actually, it was like 2 minutes to sunset, and they'd gotten close, but they hadn't quite got there, and they weren't going to make it. They weren't going to make it. But Arjuna's life, Arjuna's a devotee. So Krishna is going to do whatever it takes to preserve his devotee and to take away from the non-devotees. And so, of course, you know the story. Krishna caused an eclipse, an untimely eclipse. The sun was covered and it went dark, and all the Kauravas thought that the day's over. The hostilities are finished. Arjuna did not accomplish his vow. And so they all relaxed and they started cheering and high-fiving each other. And then Krishna said to Arjuna, kill him now. And Arjuna notched his bow. And then Krishna also coached him that, you know, his father... Anyway, that's another story about what to do with the head. So Krishna says, Arjuna, get ready, get ready. I'm going to do something here. I'm going to do something here. He caused, with his mystic power, he caused the sun to go dark. All the Kauravas relaxed their guard. They started celebrating their victory. And now Krishna said, shoot, kill him. And then as Arjuna loosed the arrow, the sun came up again. The cloud was removed. And there was like another 30 seconds of daylight. And Jayadratha lost his head. And Krishna was unshakable in his protection of his devotees. And that's the happiness that one experiences. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, Shukam atyantikad yattad buddhi grahana tindraya vedi yatra chavyam shtitam chalati. Shtitam means unshakable. Unshakable. Who is in Krishna consciousness experiences boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. This indeed is actually freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. You know, when other people are moaning and wailing and gnashing their teeth and beating their chests and looking up at the sky and saying, why? You know what the devotee is doing? The devotee is saying, what am I supposed to learn from this? Am I supposed to learn from this? And the devotee is thinking, whatever has happened to me, you know, other people may call it a catastrophe, a calamity, and whatever. It may completely unhinge other people and make them bitter forever. But I'm not going to become bitter. I'm going to become better from this experience. I'm not going to become bitter. I'm going to take lemons and make lemonade out of it. And he feels that if I were not engaged in devotional service, if Krishna were not protecting me due to my past sinful activities before I became a devotee, much greater. I actually deserved whatever it is, cancer, heart disease, amputation of a limb, you know. I actually knew one girl. I did a class in this high school, Mountain View. And there was one girl in the class, beautiful girl, had been in an auto accident. And she had her leg taken off as a result of the auto accident. When she woke up after the auto accident, and she's a religious person, she woke up after the auto accident, and she was told that she had her leg removed. Do you know what her first statement was? I needed to lose a little weight anyway. That is unshakable, fixed up happiness. That thinking that had I got what I really deserve, it would have been much better. But because Krishna is protecting me, this is only really a small token. I don't think we have time to tell this whole story here. Why don't we just take that as a good point to end, and maybe we'll be able to resume some future time and do part two, right?